Welcome to episode two of Coral's Soapbox. Good morning, Coral. How are you?
Good morning, Matt. Good morning, everybody out there. I hope there's somebody watching this. It would be awful if we're doing all this and nobody's watching.
There are people watching. And I've had fans actually reach out to me over the last few days since we made the announcement of Coral's Soapbox saying, we love Coral, but we'd also love to hear Coral's views on news of the day as well. So I thought we could throw
So what news have you got for me today?
Well, as we said, Roe versus Wade and Mar versus Hamish. Just too interesting.
And just as well, it's not Mar versus Wade and Hamish versus Roe, isn't it?
Did I get that the right way? Yes.
two big things in the news this week. One of them, I know a lot of people have asked in relationship to prisoner, why we never really dealt with the issue of abortion head on. And that's because most people don't know this, but abortion was only legal in Victoria of all the Australian states until very recently. I think it's about 5-6 years ago that it became legal everywhere else. And because the show was made not just for Victoria, but it was made for a world audience and also for all the other states, we never took a stance on it. As to what I personally feel, I don't know what's wrong with America. I mean, what is wrong with America? And why in God's name would Australians ever want to be like Americans? They have the worst bloody coffee in the world, whereas Australia arguably has the best coffee in the world. It's hard to get a bad cup of coffee in Australia unless you go to Starbucks. And it's hard to get a good cup of coffee in America. So that's the first thing. But there was such a movement to fight for women having control over their own bodies. And I think that does hark back to prisoner, because what prisoner was about largely was women who were put into circumstances that most of us can never even imagine, and how they dealt with that. And to come out on top of that means that you have to at least have control over what you do. Now, the Roe versus Wade decision has taken away that right for women. It's all part of a, you know, bloody Donald Trump and the Republicans movement to, you know, subvert women, to push them back again to being secondary citizens. One of the things that I loved about prisoner and why I wanted to do it, I mean, I think I told you the first episode, when I saw the first episode, I pointed at the television and said, I want to write that. I don't want to write any of the other Australian shows. I want to write that. was because it was about women, and it was, you know, women who made mistakes. They weren't perfect women. They made mistakes, but they owned up and paid for those mistakes. Now, if abortion is wrong, it should be up to a woman to say, well, okay, I'm prepared to do that, and I will take responsibility for it. But how dare a court, anywhere in the world, tell a woman what she can do with her body, what she can and can't do with her body? It's absolutely disgusting. It's set equality between sexes. It's set that back 50 years now. We're going to have to start all over again. And the way to do it is not to be rampant feminists and say we hate men. The way to do it is to just keep asserting that we have the rights to make decisions about ourselves. I've had an abortion. I had an abortion while I was doing prisoner.
Wow.
I was actually doing prisoner, and I fell pregnant on my 40th birthday, so it would have been 1984, so it would have been up in the 400s somewhere. And I discovered I was pregnant, and my partner, longtime partner, Tony Druin, who suffered from bipolar disease, just said to me, I can't do it. I just can't do it. So there wasn't really any question. I needed to work because he couldn't. I had two kids already. I didn't want another baby. And so I went and had an abortion at 9:30, and at 12:30 I was back in the office plotting prisoner.
Oh my God.
Now, that's not to say that it was a nothing thing to me. Yeah. I still think about it. And I often think, well, that child would be 38 years old now. Isn't that astonishing to think that it would be 38 years old now? And would it have been a boy or would it have been a girl? You know, those are not, they're not decisions that women make lightly. But the only person who has a right to make that decision is the woman herself. So I've been irate this week. And I've, you know, really been spitting the dummy at people and saying, you know, this just is beyond belief. What is wrong with America? And the list is too long. We could spend, you know, 100 hours of tape saying what is wrong with America. But please, Australians, we don't want to be American. We're Australians. We're a kinder society. We are a, yes, of course, we have rednecks and we have people who are prejudiced. We have all of those because we're a big melting pot. But we also have kindness and compassion and the ability to mostly see the other person's point of view, which seems to be singularly lacking in America. But I don't want to get onto an American passion.
No, I mean, it's worth discussing because it does resonate with prisoner and some of the storylines, but also
yeah, it does. And I mean we took those chances back then to say you know, I mean, the blog that I wrote for Neighbours was all about looking for an abortionist. We don't want to. It would be terrible if in Australia we went back to the idea of people going to backyard abortionists. But that was the only choice. And who does it affect the worst, of course? Not the people with money. They'll always find a way. You know, they'll get on a plane and go somewhere else. It affects the poor. It affects yes. the people who can least afford to have. Yeah, they're not. They've got nowhere to go. They're going to have more children when they actually can't afford to care for the ones they've got now.
Yeah.
And it's just a recipe for disaster. It's a shocking, shocking thing. So am I pro-abortion? Yes. Am I pro-abortion up to, you know, the 36-week mark? No. I think there has to be, unless there is a medical reason, why there has to be a cutoff figure where you say, okay, now you make the decision, do you have this child or do you not have this child? And I think that that is probably around the 15, 16 week mark. But that's my personal view, and I would not say to anyone else, well, you're crazy if you don't have that view. I would just say, what the f- is wrong with you? That's all I would say.
And what I'm about to say is very dark, but what I also read last night was that even from rape and incest...
I know. So you can be raped by someone you had never met before in your life, and you are supposed to love that baby, which is a product of rape. And when that baby asks, who is my father, say, I don't know, he raped me. Your father is a rapist. It's just... Well, as I said to my quite feminist liberal daughter, it beggars belief. It's almost like you're watching The Handmaid's Tale or something.
Yes.
It just beggars belief that in this year, 2022, a Supreme Court of a country should interfere with what a woman is allowed to do with her body. It's outrageous. Just outrageous.
Crazy. Crazy. On a lighter note is the Logies. Now,
yes.
Did you watch the Logies?
Poor Ray missed out. I have to say, we have to remember that John Woods missed out for 7 years. He was nominated 7 times for Blue Heelers and didn't win. Do I think it's the right decision? Well, actually, yes, I do, because the Gold Logie is for the best personality of the year. And Ray is an actor playing a role. Now, if Alf Stewart had been nominated as Best Personality of the Year, then the Gold Logie should have gone to Alf Stewart. But Ray is playing a role, and I don't think actors playing roles should get gold Logies. They should come into the most outstanding actor category or most outstanding actress category. So do I support Hamish Blake? Yeah, sometimes I'm a fan of Hamish's, sometimes I'm not. But Hamish is a personality. He's not an actor. Yeah. He's not learning lines and then inhabiting someone else's body. He's always Hamish. And Ray is an actor. I mean, give him an award for playing Craven. Give him an award for playing Alf. But don't give him an award for being the best personality, because if he's a good actor, we don't know what Ray's personality is. We only know what Alf's personality is. So, yeah, I think Hamish was the right choice, given the list of people that there were. I thought he was the right choice.
Have you, you've been to a Logies when you're working in the industry?
Would you believe, and I said this to someone recently who said, oh, I'd love to know what writers were there. Unless a writer creates the series, which was the case with...
Pacific Drive.
What's it called? The Newsreader.
Newsreader, yeah.
Which was Michael Lucas, which picked up all the award, picked up the best actor, best actress, best writing, best drama series. Unless the writer is actually the creator of the show, then writers do not get invited. So I've never, ever been invited to a Logies. I've been to one Logies because back in the 1960s, my father won a Logie for his show Time for Terry, which was a show, a daily variety show pre the Mike Walsh show and the Ray Martin show. He won best state personality, and I went to that Logie ceremony with him. But for all the others, no, I've never been.
Wow.
Never been.
Wow. It's changed. I mean, it's not like it used to be.
No. And look, it's a night of people patting themselves on the back, but by and large, it's a personality thing. It's a fan thing.
Yeah.
It's fan thing. Now, I won an Orgie, as you probably know, which was
the Home and Away
writers. Pardon?
For the Home and Away episode with Elf.
For the Home and Away episode with Elf. Yeah, and I didn't think I would be thrilled to win it, because I knew that a lot of people who were voting, I didn't think were very good writers. When I heard I had won it, I was actually surprisingly touched, because it was other writers who were choosing me to win that award. And when I, the following year, met some of the judges, they weren't supposed to tell me they were judges, but they were. My hair's falling down. I do apologize. I'm desperately in need of a haircut. And when they said how gobsmacked they were by the script, because it was so unlike any other soap script they had ever read, I was really touched. I was very, very touched, and I felt really good about winning it. And it sits, just so that people know what we're talking about, where does it sit? Hang on. Ta-da!
There it is. Wow, how good is that?
That's the old one. They redesigned it, and the new one is very, very much nicer. But that is the old one, and that is the actual one that I won. And it sits in pride of place in my office. And on the opposite wall, there is a certificate saying that I won it. So, and I think, I'm not sure if I told this on air before or just to you, Matt, but that script is, sorry about that, that script is probably the quickest script ever written for television. It ran 23 minutes and it took me 31 minutes to write it.
31? What?
31 minutes. I wrote it on the fly, as we say, which means as you go. I was behind. I was sitting in my office. I was writing the scenes longhand. They were going to the typist she was typing them up, and then they were going to Phil Saunders, the editor, and he was editing them. By that stage, I knew how to time a scene within 5 seconds, which you have to start, you know, you have to time every scene within 5 seconds. And I said to him, don't worry about timing it because the timings are right. And he timed a couple of scenes and he said, you're right, they were within 5 seconds. Every scene was within 5 seconds. But, you know, I didn't expect to, I thought that that episode, I was kicking myself when I finished it because I realised that the story was a great opportunity, but I wasn't supposed to write it in the first place. Another writer was supposed to write it. They dropped out for whatever reason. I can't remember what it was. And I said, no, I'm not trusting it to anyone else to bugger up. I'll do it myself. And so it came to be written on the fly. When Bevan Lee read it, he said, I will eat my hat if you don't win a Logie if you don't win an Orgie, the Writers Guild Awards, for this script. So I actually got a cloth hat and I stitched those long pieces of licorice all around the border for him to eat his hat. And bugger me, I won and he didn't have to eat his hat. So I had it in my bag at the Logies because Bevan was there. And I had so wanted to pull it out and say, come on, eat your hat. And I won. So he didn't have to eat his hat.
That's interesting.
Because that's not a popularity contest.
Yeah.
You know, that was writers choosing writers. That's why I think the Screen Actors Guild has more awards, has more weight for actors than the Oscars does, because the Oscars are voted on by everyone, and even though they're in the film business, if you are employed in props on films, if you're a member of the Academy, you still get to vote for who the best is. You might know absolutely nothing about photography or absolutely nothing about writing or acting. And so, you know, you have to think, well, should everybody vote? And if everybody votes, shouldn't it just be called a popularity contest rather than for the skills? If it's for the skills, then it should be the people who have those skills who are saying, bloody hell, I wish I'd written that, or I wish I'd done the camera work on that.
Yeah.
So Hamish, yes, good on you, Hamish.
And just going back when you said you wrote an episode on the fly, I do have an interesting question. Is I remember, I think it was episode 3 when we spoke to Ian Bradley, he was talking about how he wrote an episode of Prisoner on the train on Annie's feet. You know, he had her feet and he was riding. He had to write an episode quickly. Where's the most interesting place you've written a script?
The toilet. The toilet. I was quite sick with gastro. And so I stayed home for a couple of days and I had a script to write. And in those days, of course, there were no programs for writing scripts on computers.
Yep.
You know, they were written on typewriters. And you used either whiteout to correct it, or you had a self-correcting typewriter, a golf ball typewriter, where you just, you know, put the white tape up and then typed over the letters and it looked like it had lifted them off. You know, just amazing. People would be amazed if they saw the lack of technology we had.
Did you have to type your own scripts?
Pardon?
Did you have to type your own scripts or you'd write them and give them?
Yeah, we had to. Well, I had my partner, Tony Druin, who taught himself to become, he could have got a job as a secretary. He taught himself to touch type 90 words a minute.
Wow.
And I would hand over, and he knew my handwriting as much as anybody did, because it's indecipherable sometimes. And the more into the script I get, the worse the handwriting gets, because I get more and more involved and more excited. So the worse the handwriting gets. But he taught himself to touch type and I would hand the pages to him. But when I had the 2 days with gastro, I was running backwards and forwards to the toilet all the time. So I was taking my foolscap folder of paper, which is looks like this. This is how I used to write. In fact, this has probably still got notes from Home and Away or something on it.
Wow.
And, you know, I keep them even though I use a new one each time I start something. I took it into the toilet with me with a biro and I just sat there. I thought there's no point in getting off and going back out because I'll be coming back in again. So if I can't remember what the script was, but if it gave anybody the shits, I can truthfully say me too.
Oh, love it. Love it. And just before we get into Prisoner, the newsreader, I actually only just recently watched that last week and I thought it was brilliant. Amazing.
It's a writer called Michael Lucas. It took him, and this will tell people, I haven't got the patience to do what most people do. Most people, most writers, they have a project and they nurture it and they nurse it for year after year after year after year. And that was the case with Michael Lucas with the newsreader. It took over 5 years, something like 6 or 7 years to get it made. But he stuck with it because it was his baby. I had so many ideas. I mean, if you went through my bottom drawer, there are people who say to me, "That what about that show you created about such and such?" And I go, huh? I probably have created, none of which have gone into production because I didn't stick with them for long enough. And that's my problem is I don't have ADHD. I couldn't have done what I did if I had ADHD. But what I have is a singular lack of any patience. So I will say, okay, I'll give 6 months of my time to creating this project and getting someone to pick it up and let them do the 5 years of work trying to get it made.
You move on to something else.
And I've moved on to something else. And so there are probably 4 or 5 programs that I created, which I wish I had persisted with, particularly one called The Shift, which was almost like a reality show, except it wasn't. It was clearly scripted and it was about paramedics on a night shift. And it was only ever, we never went into the hospital. The plan was that there would be a spin-off, which was internet only, which you then watched after the show and you saw what happened to the patient once they went into the hospital.
Oh, wow.
And it keeps coming back to haunt me because people keep saying, I still remember that show of yours, you know, and I don't know why it didn't happen. I got funding from funding bodies, etc. I worked with my daughter, Kelly Lefevre, on it. I worked with, you know, a lot of very well-known writers and artists on it. Yeah. It looked like it was going to happen 3 times and it never happened. And that is largely because I didn't give it the commitment I should have, but I'd already moved on to other things. See, the thing for me is not about seeing it on the screen. It's about getting it out of my head and onto the page.
But you say once that, you pretty much created Pacific Drive, which is a show we'll talk about in the future, but you stayed on Pacific Drive for a long time.
I stayed on Pacific Drive until I realized, and we will talk about it more fully, until I realized that the producer and I were on such different pages that it was never going to be what I wanted to be. I don't know if you ever watched it, but it was, you loved it.
I love Pacific Drive.
It was meant to be an Australian version of Melrose Place, which I thought was outrageous.
But it was.
And I thought, let's do something outrageous, something where people go, oh, my God, I can't believe they did that. And so you had scenes like, I remember one scene in one of the early eps where they were having sex in a motorboat. And he used her pantyhose to tie the steering wheel in the one position. And then we cut to a long shot and the motorboat's just going round and round and round in circles while they're bonking on it. So it was meant to be tongue-in-cheek. It was meant to be a send-up of all the excessive over-the-top shows that we'd seen from America. And to his great credit, Bevan Lee got it completely, but the producer didn't get it. And so every week I was having to explain to him, why does it have to be that way? Because da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he didn't get it. He did, and certain of the directors didn't get it. I mean, I think I told you in one of the Talking Prisoner eps that one of the directors took a whole episode which was set at night because we had, set the episode starting at when the sun went down and then run through until the sun came up. And he wanted to shoot in the sunshine. He wanted to shoot all the luxury boats. So he just said, oh, we'll just make all of that night into day. Well, of course, in the daytime, the story did not work at all.
Yeah.
Wow. It was designed, the story was written to be told from the point of view of, it's all bright and sunny in the daylight, but at night it's dark and it's seedy and it's this. Yeah. So I stuck on Pacific Drive for the first 100 episodes, which is not insubstantial. Most shows don't run 100 episodes. I mean, I don't think that the 8 seasons of Wentworth has run 100 episodes.
No, it hasn't, no.
No. So in the whole 8 seasons, they didn't run 100 episodes. So I stuck it for 100 episodes, and then I very publicly resigned, and I very publicly said I had no faith in the producer, which was a silly thing to do because then no producers wanted to work with me in case I said I had no faith in them. But Pacific Drive could have been, and it was always meant to be, people said, oh, they bumped it up to being a late night show. It was always meant to be a late night show. Yeah. It was going to move further and further almost into the soft porn territory because women like soft porn. You know, they like to see shots of a man undoing their underwear or pulling their panties off. What they don't want to see is humping bodies under a sheet because it's boring. Men are quite happy to see that or without the sheet, but women aren't titillated by that. So it was meant to be that kind of a late night show, always. It was never meant to be like Paradise Beach or like Breakers or any of those serials which were for a teenage young adult audience. This was meant to be for grown-ups who'd seen all the outrageous Melrose Place type shows and enjoyed having the piss taken out of them.
Yeah, sure.
But it was a failure, and you know, I have to own that it was a failure. Funnily enough, not long after I left, the producer actually saw, it may have been Trey and Amber's wedding in the graveyard, in the cemetery, but the producer did turn around to Bevan and say, oh, my God, now I get it. Well, he was about, 6 months too late to get it,
You know who really stood out to me on that show was, and I think she was maybe unknown at the time, was Kimberly Joseph. She was amazing on Pacific Drive.
What did she play?
The character, I'll look it up. She played, what was it? I love Pacific Drive. I'm just trying to remember the character's name was...
Because it's so long ago, I can't associate the characters with the names of the actresses except for a very, very few.
Yeah, well, I think she was in it from the... I'm trying to remember now. I'd have to go back and look. I'd go
save
back...
Save it for Pacific Drive. I'll remember by then.
Yeah. No, well, there is a lot of fans out there for that show, so it will be a good one.
There was supposed to be a 25th anniversary reunion a couple of years ago.
Really?
And for some reason it never happened, But I know that there would have been a few people who would have come because those who got what the show was trying to do. Incidentally, the part of, I can't remember his name. The guy who falls in love with Melissa Kurtz. Dampier, what's his name? Oh, God, isn't that terrible? I'm so sorry, poor actor. But that part was supposed to be played by Simon Baker. And right before we went into production, Simon Baker went over to see casting agents in America and got picked up in America. And so if he'd been in Pacific Drive, he probably wouldn't have been available to do The Mentalist, and he probably wouldn't have become a big name in America.
Because he was just coming off the back of E Street at that time.
Yes.
He played the cop.
Coming off the back of E Street. We wanted him, and we were in negotiations for him. And so I was writing as if we got him. And then I heard, hold your horses. It's not going to happen. But Pacific Drive did break a lot of new ground. And I'm glad we're going to do a show on Pacific Drive, because it did break a lot of new ground. I mean, the new ground wasn't always appreciated. You will have figured by now, because I'm sure you've got feedback from people saying how they adore me, but you've also got feedback people saying, get that bloody bitch off the screen. I'm sick of looking at it. I don't want to hear any more of it. So I think my work in shows tends to polarize people.
That's a good thing though. It's a good, you know,
it's a, you know, if you're not pissing someone off, you're not doing it properly.
That's true.
I honestly believe that, because if everybody loves what you're doing, you're playing too safe. You're going straight down the middle, and there's nothing contentious, and there's nothing for people to get riled up about. If you're not pissing people off, you're not doing it properly. And that includes producers and heads of networks and everyone else. If you've got to piss them off and hope they don't fire you. In most cases, they fired me. And in some cases, they then rehired me because they realized, hey, it was better to have me on the show doing good work, even if they had to put up with me, you know, pissing them off. And Peter Pinney, through my time on Prisoner, the Grundys were Reg Watson, Peter Pinney, and Don Batty. And I've now become good friends with Peter Pinney, who for 40-odd years referred to me as that woman. But I've become good friends with him. And he's in hospital recently because he's in his 80s now. And he phoned me to see if I would review, because he now, like me, reviews theatre. That's what he does. It's more a hobby than a job, but it keeps our writing skills in. And he rang me up and said, listen, would you review 9 to 5 for me? Because I'm in the hospital and I can't get to do it. And we got on to talk. I said to him, he said, who would have ever thought that we had a mutual love of musical theatre? And I said, what you mean back in the days when you called me that woman? And he said, oh, let's not go there. Let's not go there. And I said, you have to be honest, though, because I did leave the show and then I came back again 3 or 4 months later. I said, to be honest though, I was the best story editor stroke script producer you ever had on that show. And he went, you want me to say yes? And I said, I just want you to be honest. And he said, we'll have to meet and have a coffee and talk about it. So I wasn't prepared to.
That's one of the things I love about you, though. Hang on, I think I've lost you. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Still having trouble hearing you, though. Have you got a volume control you're in?
No, it's all good here. Just froze for a little bit.
Oh, that's a little bit better.
Yeah. No, one thing I love about you is that you stick to your morals. So if you've got a story that you've written and a producer come along and said, no, it should be that way, you will stand up and say no. This is the way it's going to be.
Absolutely. And now that is the way it is, because finally, 40 years further down the track, the powers that be have realized if you have not got great writers and great storytellers, you haven't got a show.
Yeah.
You haven't got a show. And so that's why I take issue with people who say, oh, you know, the first 2 years of Prisoner were the best. I never watched it after that. Well, if you never freaking watched it after that, how do you know the first two series were the best? The first two series were great because they were unique. No one in the world, because within these walls was not like Prisoner. It was largely about the governor and the warders. Yeah. And the prisoners were all baddies. But no one in the world had ever seen a show like that before. And so without those first two series, Prisoner would not be what it is to people today.
Yeah.
But the best stories, the best work, and some of the worst work, and I would love to do one episode on stories that failed miserably and shows that failed miserably and why. And I know one of the ones that we have discussed is the Michael Cormack in drag as so that he could be close to his girlfriend. And I won't get sidetracked into that now. We will save it for best and worst stories. Sure. Otherwise, we won't get on to Top Dogs and Nasties.
Yes, but we are going to get into honesty, now.
Yeah, and also we will talk about Daphne and Pixie. So for those who are looking to see what is coming up, I would like to talk about those characters that don't fit into either Top Dogs or Nasties. And we could call that, Matt, the characters you loved, people that we just loved, and we could put three dots and then put all hated, because I know a lot of people didn't like Lexi and they didn't like Marlene, but most people loved them, and they loved Daphne and they loved Pixie and they loved Judy. And you know, if I had to play a role on Prisoner, if I had ever had the chance to play a role on Prisoner, I would have wanted to play Judy Bryant.
Oh really?
Not that is governor. Who I would.
I could see you as the governor.
Oh, can you? No, I'm a softie. I'm Ian Smith, who we all know from either Neighbours or Prisoner, said to me once a very long time ago, I used to think you were a cow, but now I realise you're just a potty calf.
I loved his character on Prisoner, Mr. Douglas.
Yeah, not, I can't claim credit for that, but that's very much like Ian is off screen.
Wow.
As is Harold, much like Ian is off screen.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, a lot of the characters were very much like the people were off screen.
And it's funny you mentioned Lexi just before. So we, Pepe Trevor's interview just went up last week, I think on Friday. And, you know, it's been popular, a lot of comments. And there was an interesting comment was, never liked the character, but love Pepe, love the interview. And now I love the character. Like some of them are gone, I actually love Lexi now after seeing Pepe on an interview.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Pepe is really, I created the character, but Pepe gave her life. And Pepe avoided, unlike some actors, Pepe avoided being Pepe. I mean, Pepe brought to Lexi a totally different dimension, which was, you know, often sarcastic and a bit sour and a bit, and that's not Pepe at all, which just goes to show Pepe's a bloody good actress, a really good actress. And, you know, a lot of people didn't like Marlene. They thought she was stupid and dumb. Well, you know, she was your typical 18-year-old at the time. You know, I want to belong. I want to be part of everything. So I don't fit in with the girls because I'm fat and not terribly pretty. So there's a lot of me in Marlene, I have to say.
Yeah.
That whole idea that you go out with the boys and because they're doing dumb things, you say, hey, let's throw a rock over the bridge onto the motorway. And it, you know, it goes through a car window and kills somebody.
Yeah.
That is, you know, does that make her a bad person? No, she's a good person who did a dumb, stupid thing because part of her is a dumb, stupid person. But it doesn't make her a bad person. Genevieve Lemon is a fantastic performer, absolutely fantastic. And the proof of that is the longevity that she has had. She's done leads she played the lead role, not Billy Elliot, of course, that was a boy, but she played the teacher in Billy Elliot on stage here through several tours. She's been in the Pirates of Penzance. She's been in heaps and heaps of musicals, heaps and heaps of plays. She got her entire kit off for steaming, which is a big thing for a young actress to do. I was offered that role in the first production. Really? Yeah, and I thought about it. And I thought, oh, no, everyone will see my fat. And I turned it down.
Oh, wow.
Because I didn't have enough confidence in myself as an actress to let people see it. Nowadays, I would do it in a hit. I mean, I would do a play like Calendar Girls and get my gear off in a hit because who cares? I'm in my 70s. Nobody's going to be looking at me and saying, well, I wouldn't want to bonk that. So... I would think there was something wrong with any bloke that did.
I have to say, you mentioned 9 to 5. I did see that photo of you on Facebook on the way to 9 to 5, and you look glamorous.
Yeah. Oh well, I don't make a big effort for this because I like it to be more that we're just talking rather than that, you know, I've got up and spent 2 hours putting a makeup. I'm gonna take this bloody alligator clip out of my hair and just do this with it.
I'm just looking at the time. Now, we did run out of time last time, and so we're going to bring Daphne and Pixie into another.
Bring episode. Daphne and Pixie into characters that we loved. But let's talk about...
Who's the first one?
Because I know you like the top dogs and the nasties. Everybody likes the top dogs and the nasties. And, of course, the thing is, the top dog can only be on the prisoner side, but the nasties can be on either side. So... you can only have one top dog at a time, which is why when you introduce another top dog or a would-be top dog, there's always going to be a challenge between them to see, like there was between Minnie and Sonia, neither of which were meant to be long-term because we were desperately scrambling to get Annie Phelan, and she and I was creating Myra with a proper backstory and everything, so that, which is why there are anomalies between her earlier appearances and her later appearances, because we knew she was virtually taking over the show. So she had to gel with Maggie as Joan, and she had to be a bigger, better version of B. So what the qualities that you need to create a top dog. You will hear people who are writers talk about scripts and say, oh, well, you have to have a protagonist and you have to have an antagonist. And another way of saying that for lay people is you have to have a hero and you have to have a villain because you have to have someone for them to play against. Because in the long run, most stories, not all stories, but most stories come down to, you've only got a few stories. You've got the triumph over adversity. Someone has, the world throws everything at them, but somehow they come out on top. And almost all of Prisoner, by its very nature, because the women were stuck behind bars, included an element of the triumph over adversity story. The other story you can have is the redemption story, where somebody is a baddie, but they do something good, and that redeems them from what they've done. And then there are the obviously there are the thwarted love stories and a few others, but Prisoner hinge largely on redemption stories and triumph over adversity stories. So if you're saying, okay, we've got this heroine hero, if we're going to be gender non-specific, can you imagine if Prisoner was gender non-specific? What a freaking mess it would be.
I'm sorry, I don't get all this. I don't identify and all the.
Well, I'm glad you don't get it because you're only 40 odd, aren't you?
44.
And I'm 78. And I think, what is this all about? From now on, I choose to be known as one of my favorite comedians and such a great actor, Eddie Izzard, now chooses to be known as she. I mean, he's been a crossdresser for 30 years and all of a sudden. And bisexual for 30 years, all of a sudden I choose to be known as she. Well, I'm sorry, Eddie. you're not she to me.
Quickly, I watched that Ricky Gervais special a few weeks ago on Netflix. I mean, he offended everyone. But I loved it. I thought it's so true. Like, it's so
well. As I said, if you don't offend anyone and you're a comedian, you're not doing your job. That's why political correctness, as you know, I did stand-up comedy for 25 years, and I grossly offended people, and mostly I offended. I used to play on the fact that I was very overweight with very, very large tits, 44D tits. So. You know, I used to pick on skinny women in the audience or quite normal sized women in the audience, you know, and say, oh, you wouldn't. And I would say, fellas, would you want to bonk that? You know, look at the hips. They're like razor blades. You cut yourself to pieces, you know, and that is the level of comedy I was doing. Now I wouldn't be allowed to do it. I remember I used to do a whole load of Irish jokes, and then Al Grasby got into Parliament. You weren't allowed to do any ethnic jokes. So I used to start, and I used to tell the audience, I can't do my Irish jokes anymore. So there were two aliens walking down the street, because you can do aliens. So there were two aliens walking down the street. One turns to the other and says, hey, Paddy, what do you think about that then? Like, do it all with an Irish accent. That was my way of doing my Irish jokes, pretending they were aliens. But getting back to, I'm getting diverted again. It's your fault. It's not my fault. It's your fault. You lead
back to
me
Myra.
Astray.
Myra.
Okay, so Myra, creating Myra and creating any top dog, what has she got to be? She's got to be strong. She's got to be strong enough to take on the strongest person there and beat them, but not for her own gain. She's got to be compassionate. She's got to understand that everybody doesn't have her strengths, that there are people who are weaker than she is. And it's her job, if she's top dog, she takes on that responsibility for looking after them. She's got to be emotionally connected. In other words, it's got to be, how does someone else feel about something rather than how I feel about something? So it's got to be for the good of the women, so that if someone comes up against her and threatens the women or the people she is responsible for or the status quo that she has established, she is strong enough to fight them. And that's why I maintain that. And I know there are people who don't agree with me, and that's absolutely fine. It depends what you want from a show. I saw Penn and Teller this week, and they were absolutely fantastic. But they said, Penn said, we do simple, simple tricks. And you can take them as simple tricks. That's fine if that's the level you want to take them on. But if you want to look a little bit deeper, you will find subtlety and nuance and narrative storyline and all of those things which some people need in order to engage. So my reason for maintaining that Myra is a better top dog, was a better top dog than B. Smith, was not because I created Myra and I didn't create B. Smith. Not at all. It was simply because B. Smith wasn't drawn with those characteristics clearly enough delineated. Too many times, I don't know if you felt this, but too many times when I was watching it, long before I ever thought I would get a writing gig on it, I thought, yeah, but that's not really fair to the others. That's what she wants. That's not really the best thing for the women. So she didn't have didn't have the right degree of compassion, had the strength, had all of the strength, didn't have the right degree of emotional engagement. Myra would treat someone who was in pain or distress very differently. B would be very much about, well, get over it, you know, we're in here and we're fighting to stay alive and we just deal with it. Whereas Myra would understand that not everyone could deal with it. So that's a reason why I say she was Myra Desmond. Forget about Annie Phelan and what's her name? Oh, God. Val Lehman. Forget about that. I genuinely did for that moment blank out her name. I'm sorry about that, Val. I just think that the character was better drawn. You know, I just think that Val could maybe have played all those things, and we tried to give her some stories that showed a softer side. But B. Smith was so locked into being, you know, cross me and, you know, I'll stick your hand under the press, or that, you know, you never expected her to say, it's going to be okay, and put her arms around her, somebody, and then go after a screw and say, you bitch, you are history because of what you did to her. You never saw her do that. It was always, she would say to the other women, I'm going to get them. I am going to get him. But she never, ever took an honourable stand and faced the person and said, you know, I am responsible for them, and therefore you are answerable to me. And that's why I think Myra was a better drawn top dog. When you look at people who attempted to be top dog, or who we put in that top dog role for a little while, you've got the Minnie Donovans, who that was coming off of, and Wendy Playfair was such a terrific actress. Yeah. But she was, we were in that hiatus between Bea leaving, Val leaving, and Annie being available and us getting her in.
And just on that note with Annie, like saying bringing Annie in. So, just behind the scenes, is it, did you guys go, we need a new top dog, or you had Annie first, so what do we do with Annie? Do we put her?
No, we didn't have Annie first. We had, from the moment they said Val is definitely going, I started thinking about what we needed in a replacement. In the same way as I did when Gerda came in and took over the governorship from the lovely, gorgeous Patsy, who again was drawn very two-dimensionally. You know, she was either, everything was black or white, and I wanted someone who was a bleeding heart liberal who did make mistakes, but was strong enough to correct them if she did. So we had this hiatus period where we knew there was going to be a gap of about 3 months, maybe a little bit more, where we could not have brought Myra in straight on top of B, because the audience would not have accepted her. They would have said, oh shit, you know what, they got rid of thing, they do this, you know. The audience needed time to adjust to the fact that B had gone. And so there were two characters which were always intended to be short-term characters, but who we thought could play off each other. And that was Minnie Donovan and Sonia Stevens. Now, neither of them had the qualities to stay long-term. They didn't have the qualities that I've just described that a top dog has to have. And so they could make place for power, but ultimately both of them were going to be unseated, because neither one of them had the right. It's a bit like saying, well, if Prince Charles died and William wasn't available, would you put Prince Andrew on the throne of England? No, I don't think you would. Doesn't have the right qualities to be king. William does, but
which qualities Andrew... are you talking about?
And so they were quite deliberately a stopgap. Sonia, who was a terrific actress, Tina Bursell's a terrific actress, very attractive lady, knew every line, actually asked questions about, when I'm doing this, am I really fooling people, or am I truly believing this? She wanted to know. We never got those questions from a lot of the other actresses, never. They just said, oh, I'm going to play it like this. They were always meant to be stopgap characters.
What do you think about what do you think about the fans that were so undivided? Like, they're so divided on Minnie's character. They just think
that's good.
Minnie was
it's just good. Again, it's good. I never wanted an audience to. I don't know if you're a rugby fan. I'm an NRL fan. So are you not a sports person or?
A little bit, but well, I mean, rugby's big where you are and not, you know, football, AFL's big here.
AFL's big there. Well, yeah. I watched the State of Origin last night. And Billy Slater, who's one of my heroes, because I support the Melbourne Storm, I will always be a Melbourne Storm supporter. Billy Slater was asked, because the Blues were in front at the half time, he was asked by somebody, oh, what do you think, Bill? You know, got so-and-so off and Kafusi's off and they're ahead. And instead of saying, yeah, I know, we have to pull our socks up, we have to do this, Billy Slater turned around and said, yes, and what a great opportunity for our guys. He saw that, the fact that they were behind and that there were people saying, oh, you're going to lose, you're going to, that's a great opportunity. I love it when people say they hate a character. I love it. There's a couple of people have apologized to me for saying, I said I didn't like that, but I'm so sorry. And I say, I love it when people are divided. Yeah. If people all felt the same, that means I've failed. I've just taken a safe middle line, and I'm not about taking a safe middle line. Same as I accept that there are some people who can't stand me being on the screen talking about this. They say, well, what a load of shit. We just want to see the show and see the actresses. That's all we care about, and that's fine. But I love it that there are people who feel that way. So, you know, Minnie is one of those characters. Some people think, oh, she was a breath of fresh air because she was totally different. She had a different way of finagling people into, oh, darling, oh, don't you? Oh, well, that's okay. Well, what about if we did this then? How would you, you know, she had a different way, which doesn't work in a prison. You know, would have worked if she'd been a human resources officer for a company or something, but doesn't work in a prison. But I wanted people to see that that didn't work. And then with people like Luke Kelly and Reb Keane, who, you know, had their moments to prove they could be top dog, I wanted people to see that they couldn't, because they were basically out for themselves. They really, as long as their first and foremost thought was, what's in this for me? Or how do I get out of this? Not how do I make things better for the women? How do I make things right for somebody who's been wronged? And that was, you know, what we tried to imbue in Myra, at the same time as making her quite capable of bashing heads if she had to.
Definitely.
Quite capable. Yeah. And Rita was another one of that ilk, although Rita got changed quite a great deal in the process, because I had already left before she entered. And it's very interesting that I think I told you in the last one of these that we did that originally that role was, I created the Rita Connors role for this 6'2", glorious looking Amazonian music theater and stage and cabaret and recording performer that we have here called Rhonda Birchmore. Those of you overseas can easily look her up if you're interested in who might have played Rita Connors.
Wow.
And I was talking to Rhonda last week, because she has become over the years a really good friend, but she did not know until very recently that I had written that role for her. And we talked about how she might have played Rita, because she was a big Prisoner fan. She watched Prisoner back in those days. And it was quite interesting, because it was a very, very different take, on what Rita would have been. Rita would have been a lot funnier, and Rita would have been a lot more unpredictable. Rita would have been really funny, had everybody laughing, and then spun on somebody and said, who the fuck are you laughing at, and bashed them. You know, she would have been that type of a character, and she would have looked down on people from her 6'4" and say, I know you're here, I can hear your voice, I just can't see you. I mean, she would have been a totally different Rita Connors.
Yeah.
But Glenda brought her own magic to Rita. But Rita still had all those elements that make a good top dog. She would listen to people if they were in the right. She wouldn't listen to them if they were in the wrong. But if they were in the right, she would listen to them and she would act upon it. Whereas people like Lou, Reb, Cass wasn't capable of making decisions, but I thought she could be the heavy power for Minnie. But we knew that was only going to be short term. Really, it boils down to three top dogs. And those three top dogs are Bea Smith, Myra Desmond, and Rita Connors. In all that time, they say, oh, so-and-so was top dog for a little while. Well, if that was for a little while, it means they weren't really top dog. Yeah. They didn't have the strength or the power to stay in that position.
Yeah.
So we had three top dogs. Of those three, my favorite is Myra. Obviously, my favorite is Myra because I did the most work on her. And she was the most like what I wanted to see. So got to love your children. I mean, it'd be a bit awful if you didn't love your children.
Now, with Annie, so the terrorist episodes, which is another episode I'd love to discuss in the future, but she was obviously written out in those episodes. She was killed off. So for the fan, you know, for everyone, what was the reasons that Annie left prisoner? Was it a page?
Okay. I thought we covered this in one of the Talking Prisoner eps, but maybe you and I just talked about it. Grundys were really, really tight with money.
Yep.
Really tight with money. I mean, Val gives various reasons for wanting to leave, including saying, oh, the storylines were getting silly and blah, 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 blah. The reason basically was Val stuck it to them for money and they weren't going to come at it. And the reality is they could not come at it. There was profit for Grundy's in overseas sales, but there was no profit in much the same way as Neighbours has ended, because it can't be produced simply on the Australian sales. It needs a major country like America or England. The same was true with Prisoner. And we got a lot of those overseas sales after the show actually finished production in Australia. So there was no money coming in to give them huge pay hikes. Annie got it in her head that if we could hire a helicopter, then if Grundy's had the money to hire a helicopter, then they had the money to pay her an extra $200 an episode. That's all it was, $200 an episode.
Which back then would have been similar to maybe, what, $600 or $700 now?
Oh, no, about
$1,000.
Maybe about $1,000 an episode extra, so $2,000 a week extra.
Okay.
And I argued that we pay her that. You know, I said, she's worth it to us. She has a following. She had a huge following. At the time, the show was going to air through its initial run, right up to 1985, six, whatever it was. Myra was far more popular than Bea had been. Far more popular. And I said, let's pay it to her. And they said, number one, we can't. We don't have the money. And number two, we can't have an actor, because it's already been tried on us with the last top dog, saying, if you don't give me more money, I'm going to walk out. And so they said, either she has to stay because she wants to stay, or you have to write her out. Can you write her out? And I said, well, you can write any character out. What's the minimum amount you can write her out in? Because we don't want to have to renew the contract, because it was contract renewal time. It wasn't like she sprang this on them at, you know, in the middle of her contract. It was contract renewal, and her agent has said, oh, okay, but we want an extra $200. It was either $200 or $250 an episode extra. And I said, will you let me talk to her? Because I met her on quite a few occasions and I liked her enormously. She's a very, very down-to-earth person. And I said, will you let me talk to her? Because I did not know until after she had gone that what had triggered all this was the helicopter. Freaking hell, they can pay for
it. What's a helicopter?
When Mari Winter escaped... She got carried off by a helicopter, right? And Annie Phelan got it in her head. I'm not even sure if Annie Phelan was the top dog when Mari Winter escaped. Yeah, I think she was.
No.
Annie got it.
No, I don't think she was.
Well, anyway, she...
I think, yeah, maybe you're
anyway, right. Anyway, she knew that there was a helicopter. If they could afford a helicopter out of the budget, then they could afford to pay her, you know, which would have cost thousands and thousands of dollars to hire a stuntman and a helicopter and everything. Then they could give her an extra $250 an episode. And she was right, if that had been the truth. But if I had been allowed to speak to her during the negotiations, which I wasn't, I would have said to her, Annie, it's the Channel 10 helicopter. They own the helicopter. It didn't cost Grundy's a single penny for that helicopter. The reason that we had a blow-up doll, which they didn't even put sand in to weight it for Mari Winter's double, is because we couldn't afford a stunt coordinator, because we would have had to pay, Grundy's would have had to pay for a stunt coordinator, and we simply couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
And so because of that, we lost Myra as top dog because of, you know, that old nursery rhyme, for want of a nail, a shoe was lost, or want of a shoe, or the horse was lost, or want of a horse, the rider was lost, or want of a rider, the battle was lost, and all for the want of a horseshoe nail. Well, that was the story. It was all because Annie had got a bee in her bonnet.
Oh.
That... If Grundy's could afford to pay for a freaking helicopter, and she said that, she didn't say the F word, she said freaking, if you guys can afford to pay for a freaking helicopter, you can afford to give me $250 a week.
So do you think if you were able to tell her and speak to her, she would have stayed on?
If I had been able to explain all that to her, I, in my heart of hearts, I believe she would have stayed.
Wow.
I believe she would, because she was a very fair person, Annie. And I think the reason why I liked her so much, and I guess she would have been the second character who I would have liked to play if I hadn't played Judy. I would have liked to play Myra.
Myra.
But there was a lot of me in Myra, which was this strong sense of justice. There's a strong sense of justice in Myra. You're an arsehole and you're going down because you deserve to go down. You were just a stupid kid who did something silly, and I'm going to look after you and make sure that this doesn't turn you into her. That was what Myra was about. That's what I'm about in life. And as a writer, I hope is that, you know, I have a sense, and I'm a Libran, and the scales, when they're balanced, they're very well balanced. A lot of the time, I know you can only see one hand here, and I can't get both hands. Yes, I can. But most of the time, I'm either up like this or down like this. But when my scales are balanced, I have a very, very strong sense of justice and righteous indignation when things are not the way they should be, when the law is not the way it should be. Well, you would have gathered that by my ranting on about, you know, abortion and Roe versus Wade and the Americans who can't even make a decent bloody cup of coffee. Jesus, I'm back to that again. So those were our three top dogs. Yes, I like to think Myra would have stayed. But if Myra had stayed, then, and some people will say, well, that's actually a good thing, there would never have been the Sonia Stevens mini story. There would never have been Rita Connors, yeah, and the way the freak was taken down. That would have been something else entirely. And so the whole of, when did Myra leave? Mid 400?
599 or something, with the terrorist siege.
No, no, Myra left before that, because Minnie and Sonia were in before that.
Yeah, they were, and then they'd gone, and then Myra was still in with the, because the terror siege, I think you wrote those episodes.
Yeah, I did, but wasn't that the Ruth Ballinger go out?
Ruth Ballinger, yeah.
Well, it was the 400s. It was somewhere in, no, it was the 500s, early 500s.
500s, yeah.
Somewhere in the early 500s. If that had happened, that we would have had no Rita Connors.
Yeah.
And there are people who love Rita the Beater.
Oh,
Bubba.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have seen her at all. They would have had Myra right through to the end of the series. And they may have, well, no, they wouldn't have had me through to the end of the series because I was a naughty girl and, you know, I told you the story last time about what me trying to do. Again, me trying to do the right thing and it backfiring and causing havoc. So I wasn't always...
Do we have time for one more character? I know we've gone over time, but do we have time for one more character?
Okay, we'll have to do the baddies next week then.
Yeah, well,
next time.
He's a baddie. And just before we get onto it, one thing that annoyed me about Prisoner and why it never happened was Mari Winter was one of my favorite characters. Maggie Miller was just, loved her. Why she was never brought back?
Maggie Miller was at the time and right through to the early 90s when 1988, I moved up to the Gold Coast and we lost contact. But Maggie would quite regularly come to my house. We hung out. Yeah. We loved each other. Maggie did not want to be tied to a long-term contract. She did not want to be, and you could not have Mari Winter, Myra Desmond, the Frigg. You know, I talked to you in one of the early ones that we did about how some characters pull focus away from others.
Yes.
Mari pulled focus away from the lead characters. Now, you can really only have, because all of storytelling is about the hero's journey, much as I've said thematically, it's about redemption or it's about triumph over adversity, you've still got to have the hero's journey going through it. Yeah. There's always, in good storytelling, someone who you latch onto and you want them to succeed. And Mari was so strong as a character, and Maggie was so strong as an actress, that you were sort of following a person over here and then going, what's she up to? Yeah. She was pulling focus. And I said, look, we can give you an epiphany and make you into a caring, gentle human being and make you top dog. But, you know, we'd need you for 3 or 4 years. And Maggie just said, oh, I'm not up for 3 or 4 years of doing this grind. She found it hard. She did find it hard work.
Yeah, she mentioned it on the interview when we spoke to her. She said it was long days.
Hard work. Very, very long days.
Yeah.
Did she talk about the fact that she could have been top dog, or did she not?
No, she didn't mention that. No. She did. She did, however, give us the laugh, that laugh.
Which was her laugh. Great lady, great actress. Terrific character. She was, you know, one of my fond memories from that time. She was terrific, and I know you would have liked to have seen her back. But Mari goes into that, for me, she goes in that grey area of, well, is she a real baddie, or is she sometimes a baddie but sometimes a goodie, or is she, whereas we had to know that the top dog was a good person who could do really bad things, but essentially a good person because they were our hero. And then you would have people like on the other side, like Len or Jock, who were bad people who could occasionally do nice things. And you'd think, hello, why are they being nice? But some people are what you see, and some people are something totally different. We are not always what we do. What we do can sometimes sit outside of what we are as a person, and it's the circumstances that make us do what we did. And that was the problem for me with to go back to the original, because we'll wrap up on Top Dogs. To go back to B. Smith, we understood why B. Smith did what she did. We understood why B. Smith took a gun and killed her husband, because he got her daughter on drugs. And is that the story? I think pretty much from memory. And her daughter had died and she was racked with grief. But that does not that is something that happened. That is something that she went through. That is not who she was. Who she was should have been who Myra became, a grieving mother who should have had compassion for other people's circumstances. But because she had so blatantly committed these crimes and wound up inside, and because she needed to survive, the writers in those first two couple of series had made her this hard-nosed bitch who would not stand any shit from anyone. And, you know, it is a fact. I mean, somebody queried it and says who, but it is a fact because we do research groups, survey groups all the time on television shows. It is a fact that men loved Bea Smith because she behaved like a bloke would behave, you know, hit somebody first and ask questions later, whereas women liked Myra better as top dog, because Myra was about, I want to be fair, I don't want to kill you if you don't deserve to be killed, but I will kill you if I have to. Totally different sensibility between them. And that was largely, you know, the fault of, but as I've said over and over again, Ian Bradley and Denise Morgan thought they were writing a 16-part show. They had no idea they were writing a 692 hours, not 692 episodes or half hours, but 692 hours. Wow. They did not look at the repercussions, because we don't in life of who is this person in 5 years' time? Who is this person in 6 years' time? Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's one more that you want to do before we wrap up this one. Who is it?
All right. Well, I know we touched on him in your interviews, but Len Murphy, played by Maury Fields.
Yeah.
I mean, what a character. So episode 493, and he left in 511. Now, one thing, I know you created this character, but one thing that really stood out to me with him was he had such a strong backstory, which you really never saw in Prisoner a lot. But he had the male inmates knew him, someone from the department knew him. I mean, it was people that knew him. And
I wanted to give him a strong backstory, and, you know, I am not, so please don't anyone post anything saying, oh, what a cow Earl Druin is, because I probably am, but not in this instance. I wanted to give him a strong backstory in order to stop Maury from being Maury. I wanted to give him all this information about the character.
Ah.
So that Maury would not come through. He would become Len Murphy. But Maury is an old vaudevillian, like myself, music hall person. And it was just too deeply entrenched in him. So every time I looked at Maury, I saw Maury doing his shtick. And I didn't believe him from an acting point of view. So not only that, but he did pull focus from Joan.
Yes.
You know, he chose to, because he would be the first to tell you that he wasn't an actor. And, you know, my dad used to say, I'm not an actor, I'm a song and dance man. You know, and so even when my dad was doing drama, which he did Homicide, and he did a series which I can't remember the name of now, which was kind of like Friends, in which he played the landlord. Can't remember the name of it. Will in time for the next one. But my dad always used to say, I'm a song and dance man, not an actor. If you want real acting, you're not going to get it from me. And Maury used to say the same thing. You know, I'm a song and dance man. But we needed, in order to make Len truly menacing. Now, in retrospect, I understand that was a fault of mine, because I saw him as a song and dance man. And I saw him, you know, he would go into his voice sort of occasionally and say, now, looky and missy. And I would think, oh, he's on Hey, Hey, It's Saturday doing Joke of the Week again. But the reality is that there were millions and millions of Prisoner viewers across the world who'd never seen Maury in music hall doing his shtick. And so I was very unfair to him, and I own that. But my justification at the time was, I just keep seeing Maury, the music hall song and dance man. However, a stronger rationale, and one that does hold up, that does not hold up, because that was in my head and I should have just got over it. Bad me. But the rationale is, he did pull focus from Joan. Maury's a very strong personality. He was strong in real life. All of us who have done what used to be called variety, we didn't really call it music hall, though in the early days it was called music hall, but in America it's called vaudeville. And all of us who came from that, and I came from that, have larger than life personalities. We're not afraid to say, fuck you. Or we're not afraid to say, well, if that's your opinion, you're just plain wrong. You know, I mean, we have big personalities. And I mean, there's someone who posts, I think from England, who said, I don't like me, you know, I don't like that character, and she makes me feel inferior, she makes me feel like, and I do that to a lot of people, and it's not an intentional thing, and it's not because I actually think I'm better than anybody. That's just who I am. You know, what you see is what you get. I'm way out there, larger than life personality, tell it exactly as I see it. And Maury was exactly the same way, and because of that, neither he nor me were very good actors. And I've often said to people, you know, who've said, oh, I loved you doing that, why didn't you do more acting? And I say just openly, I wasn't a very good actor. It's hard for me to be anyone but me. It was hard for Maury to be anybody but Maury. But the personality was so big. And you have to remember that at that time, people were still seeing him on a Saturday night on Hey, Hey, It's Saturday.
Yes, yes.
Doing his shtick, telling jokes with Val, getting out the ukulele and doing songs and things like that. Yeah, with Shane Bourne, Shane Bourne is a very good actor, but people never really accepted him in, what was it called?
Homicide, City Homicide.
Yeah, City Homicide, and the one before, which was MD something or other, which MDA or whatever it is that he did. Yeah, Shane is a very good actor, but he's a music hall person.
What do you think what do you think of Maury and the Flying Doctors? Maury and Val.
I thought he was Maury. And that was okay, because it was sort of whimsical and you kind of sort of believed him. He'd stick his hat on and you'd believe him. But he wasn't acting. It was Maury being Maury. And of course, Maury wasn't a nasty, horrible, evil person. But Len Murphy was.
Oh, yeah.
Len Murphy was a total arsehole.
Yeah.
Who hated lesbians.
Yeah, and was that you that put that into that character?
Because I don't know whether it ever came up, but part of the backstory was, and I gave it to him to play off, as a reason for him to have hated the freak, but I don't think it ever got into script, that he had been married.
Yeah, no, it was. It was.
And his wife had had an affair with a woman.
Yes.
Ever come up?
Yeah, that was in the episode.
It was in the episode that his wife had an affair with a woman.
Yeah, that's why he hated
lesbians. Right. Well, that was his reason for hating lesbians. You know, you turned my wife, you know, fuck you. Yeah. And you're one of them, so, you know, I'm going to bring you down as well as them. And he was a lovely man. He was a lovely, lovely man. He had a big ego, but we all have big egos. We would not be there. If anyone tells you, I mean, it's really interesting, because there are people who have met Val in person who have said, oh, and she's so lovely, and she's so this, and she's so that. And there are others who have met her who say, oh, my God, what an ego. Well, you have to have an ego if you are going to be the lead actor in a television show.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully you can leave it behind when you step away from the set, but you have to have an ego. Maury had an ego bigger than my little office here. It was huge. And it was about, gee, every minute I've got on screen, I'm going to make the most of it. People are going to look at me. And we couldn't have that. We just couldn't have it, because if there were two bad officers, the one we needed people to be looking at was Joan.
Yeah.
Not them.
And speaking of Joan, I'm going to pull on your memory. That fight scene between Len and Joan is one of the most talked about iconic fight scenes in prison.
Yes.
Was that you?
Yeah, that was me. Wow. That was me. And, you know, I mean, I loved doing that. I loved pitching baddies against baddies, because we'll talk in the next one, because I know we've got to get going. We'll talk in the next one about what makes a great baddie, the same as we talked about what makes a goodie. And now in that one, we can cover, so that people know what to expect and decide whether they want to watch, we can cover the real evil prisoners like Angel, who then got reincarnated as Angela in Home and Away, because she was such a good character, I wanted to reuse her all grown up. The same characteristics, because I always came to characters via their psychological profile, not by their actual backstory. And we will cover David Bridges, and we'll cover Beth Baker, and we'll cover in more detail people like Joan, who was an incredibly complex character.
You have an interesting story about Bev Baker and why she went so dark, which I do want to discuss.
Yeah. That is a really, really, and that realization only came to me in the last 10 days or so, as to why I created Bev Baker the way I did. So you remember to remind me.
I've got my notes.
Okay. Okay, so that'll be our next one. We'll talk about the baddies and why they were the baddies that they were. Right. And I hope people have had a bit of fun today. I love talking about this. Apart from anything else, it saves me from getting dementia. It makes sure that my memory still works. Yeah. And it gives the whole new generation, I hope, some perspective into what we were aiming for back in 1982, 83, 84, 85, which is almost 40 years ago. Yeah. I mean, I was like 38 years old when I started that show, and in my 40s when I left it, and I turned 78 in October. So,
wow. You don't look a day over
40. Woman who said, oh, I didn't think she would be so pretty. If you want me to, I'll do the next one. I'll take my bottom dentures out and I'll be all coming for you and I'll be a little old lady. Would you like that, Mac? Would you like me to be a little old lady without teeth? I don't think so.
You know, it was funny what Wendy Playfair said a few weeks ago was, prisoner fans, I thought they'd be all dead by now.
No, not all, but the beauty is I don't know of any other show which has such a huge fan base that was not alive when the show was made.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, call it kitsch, call it camp, call it melodrama, call it whatever you like. Name me one other show, just one, that 37 years after it finished has a whole fan base that was not even born when the show was first shown. It's just astonishing.
Amazing.
And it's, you know, as I said, and I say each time, I talk about it a lot, not because I live in the past, because I did a lot of other shows and a lot of other things in my life since then. But I'm so enormously proud that we did stories that had never been done before. We broke the mold on television. And by we, I mean everybody who sat in that chief creative chair. Ian Bradley, Denise Morgan, Dave Worthington to a smaller extent, myself. You know, we actually, and then Bev and Lee after me, and Alison LaSalle for a short while at the end. You know, we made history, and we should all be really proud. It's just that nobody else made in excess of 400 episodes of that history than me. And I'm not living in that glory in any way, shape or form. I think I've done probably some better work since then, but I don't think I've ever done more important work in the history of television than I did on Prisoner. And I love it, and I love that people still want to talk about it. So I will see you all next time. Fantastic. I know that if you have any questions, you can ask Matt, but we will talk in depth about baddies, okay?
We sure will. That was episode 2 of Coral's Soapbox. Please like and subscribe to the Talking Prisoner YouTube channel, Facebook page, Twitter, Instagram, and this episode will also be available across all the podcast platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Amazon, iHeartRadio, and wherever you get your podcasts from, and the talkingprisoner.com website. I will see you soon.
See you very soon, Matt. Take care. Enjoy Thanks, the school Carol. Holidays with your little E.
I will.
Bye, guys.
See ya. Bye.